This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about intersectionality with Dr. Monica Johnson, an incredible psychologist and host of the Savvy Psychologist's Quick and Dirty Tips podcast. It's always nice to have other shows out here which also have a long name, because sometimes it is a bit of a mouthful when people are like, and what are the name of your two shows? And I'm like, okay, do you have a pen? Dr. Monica is an incredible guest and an incredible podcaster for this topic. You'll hear in the episode she brings a lot of personal perspective to this. With that all said, let's get into this episode with Dr. Monica Johnson, and look out for a plug for her podcast at the end of the episode if you want to go hear me be interviewed all about gender and how that can relate to mental health. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I am Dr. Monica Johnson, and an early experience that I have, or that I remember with mental health, is I had an uncle who died when I was very young, around like 5.5 years old. And I remember the grief that was in my family, like during that period of time, and not fully understanding it. I understood that people were sad and that it, you know, wasn't a good thing. And I very much remember feeling awkward and feeling like I wanted to help and like not knowing like what to do. So I have a memory of bringing my mother a glass of water because that's the only thing I knew to do. And I do remember her, when she was more calm, explaining to me that this meant that I wouldn't talk to my uncle or see my uncle like ever again. It was this duality of like, I kind of understood that, but then at the same time could not really understand the magnitude of like what it meant that like I will just never talk to this person again.
Mm-hmm. And I sometimes parallel that to the ways in which we fall in love, you know, that as you grow up, you have your first loves, and then each kind of additional one, it's like, oh no, this is what love really is, because the intensity goes up and it means so much more to us, and we're thinking far more about our future and factors like that. And I can see the development of how we understand grief being similar. There are those first losses for us where each time you're like, oh, this is really grief. And for a lot of people, it is, you know, someone really close to them when they're older. And that's when you really feel like, okay, I get this emotion now. I can see in hindsight how it made sense that people were acting this way and how much of a all-consuming emotion and experience grief can be.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, at that time at 5.5, I did not understand sorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, that had not been a part of my experience yet. So seeing people sob, I was like, I know this is like not good, but I have no idea. I know how to be sad, or I know how to cry because like something broke. I don't know how to tap into the energy of someone dying, you know? And so, yeah, that's always been a memory that like stuck with me, of just like that kind of the different feelings of concern, sadness, and awkwardness and confusion over like my emotional experience in that moment. It was pretty profound.
Absolutely. I remember the first time I ever saw a family member cry, and my default assumption at a young age was, oh, they must have fallen over and hurt themselves, because my mind just went straight to, they must be physically hurt, and what can we do about that? And I think with us being a podcast about stigma, we can all see ways in which that can continue into much later life. And for you then, as you grew up, what elements of mental health were there that sort of came into your life that maybe, without wanting to make an assumption, a lot of people work in mental health because of deep personal connections to it?
Yeah, and that is a question I get often. I think, you know, or the way that it's usually phrased is they'll say, well, people go into like mental health because like, you know, they're trying to figure out their own things. And for me, it wasn't really about that. It was the fact that I was aware that I had a certain amount of resilience in me, And I saw a lot of people suffering. Not to say that I didn't have my own suffering in my life, but I saw other people suffering a lot because I grew up in poverty. And like, not pretend poverty. I had periods of time where we didn't have hot water, we didn't have running water, you know, like eating ketchup sandwiches, like that sort of thing. I just saw a lot of people and a lot of suffering and pain. And when you live in that kind of poverty, people don't have time to address their emotional experiences because everything is about survival. Mm-hmm. You know, are we going to eat today? Can we pay the rent? Like that sort of thing. And I could see the impact that that was having on people to not have time to engage in like true care for themselves. They're just kind of, you know, on this autopilot of going through the day-to-day grind. And so I think seeing all of that, plus like being exposed to, now that we're talking about it and I'm thinking about it, quite a bit of death when I was like younger, because that's another thing too. When you grow up in these types of environment, people die, like mortality rates are worse. And so I mentioned my uncle, but actually my very first friend that I had, or who I would consider to be my first friend when I was 10 years old, was a girl named Michelle. And she actually died in a car accident at the age of 10 with her mom. And she was like my first real friend. She was my best friend and literally was only in my life for maybe 4 months of my life. But I remembered that moment very clearly as well. And it did kind of mark some of my trajectory because I started journaling at the age of 10. Or no, I started writing poetry at the age of 10 as a form of expression. And I, until this day, do really see like writing and journaling as a very like solid approach for helping to like manage your mental health. You know, does it cure something? No, but it is a good technique to have that you can use that doesn't cost you any money if you don't have money or time. And so I was writing poetry. And the first poem I got published, which was at the age of 11, was the poem that I wrote about her. And it's called like My Angel. And so I remember being so struck by the fact that she wouldn't get the opportunity to like ever be like a fully formed person, that she wouldn't get to go through puberty or like graduate high school or like do any of those sorts of things. And so just witnessing all of this, these different types of suffering, and also recognizing the fact that like I appeared to cope with it a little bit better than the average person did because I was more resilient. And this is a true story. I decided to be a psychologist when I was 12. I wrote about it in my journal. I still have the journal where I said that as much as I would love to be a writer, I was like, you know, writing is something that I can keep for me. And being a psychologist is something that I can give to others. And I really wanted to take the strength that I had or have and almost do like a process of osmosis, like pass that on to other people, because I knew that like suffering is not something that's going to go away. Like we're always going to have suffering to various levels and degrees. And so it's not necessarily about the removal of that. It's about how can I cope with these moments and how can I still discover joy? And so that is something that I really wanted to help people with.
Wow. And I have to say, that's so grown up to think of you at 12 having that kind of insight and also boundaries to be like, this is the thing that I do for me and this is my outlet and this is the way in which I kind of give back to the world and the skills I can have to support others. That's, I find that really profound.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I was a serious kid. People would always say that like I'm like an old soul and that sort of thing. And again, I lived a really hard life. And so that like ages you up like very, very quickly. And I was very practically minded as well. Because I grew up in such poverty, I was like, this is for the birds. Okay, I don't wanna, I mean, to see people work themselves into the ground for pennies was a lived experience for me. My mother used to have to pick cotton before school. Like, that was like her life, working like in the fields. And she died never making more than $9 an hour, you know? And so that was something that for me, I didn't want that to be a part of my story. And as much as I love journaling and writing poetry and writing short stories, it's also very difficult to make money like writing poetry. And so there was a practical side to it for me as well, in that get myself out of poverty and also support my family, like financially, and hopefully make things easier for them.
Mm-hmm. And I really relate to that. I definitely had that from a young age, like relating to adults more. And, you know, that feeling of growing up fast and being referred to as an old soul. And, you know, honestly, I think I'm only at this point in my life feeling like my age has kind of caught up to my mm-hmm. mentality, which is nice in some ways. But also you can't help but think about the childhood elements that you didn't have. It makes so much sense that you were this practical, but also it's, you know, it is sad that you had to be. And I wonder, you know, at that point, as much as you were planning ahead, did you always see that future for yourself? You know, when you were looking at your environment around you and how people were struggling and you were around this much loss?
Oh, sure. I think the short answer is yes. Once I made the decision that I was going to be a psychologist at 12, I meant it with every like atom of my being, that I was going to put every amount of power in myself into accomplishing this goal. And I think I was the only one who believed it. I mean, my mother would talk about it later, and she would say, she's like, you would bring up college. And she'd be like, Who's paying for college? Like, we don't have anybody. And I would just be like, well, I'm going to get scholarships and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. I was such a big nerd. I used to read like 100 books a year. Like, that's all I did was like read. And I read everything. I would read the dictionary, mechanics manuals, the entire unabridged works of Shakespeare. Like, I joke all the time that I was so much smarter at 14 than I am now today. Just because, like, I read everything and I was so determined. So it's one of those situations where the answer is yes, because for me, it was that or living the way that I had seen people live, like, the entire time. And I was like, that's not an option for me. I'm not going to, like, break myself down, like, in these ways. Like, I'm just not. So, yeah, it was like that or death. And so I'm glad I was able to like work it out and figure it out. But yeah, what I try to tell people about these sorts of things, like if you find yourself in a situation where like you're like, I have all of these things that are kind of against me and I want to make my life better, but like that's a long way away. You know, it can be really overwhelming, but something I did then and something I still do now is just focus on the step in front of me. So like when I was 12, I said, well, obviously I can't be a psychologist right now, but what can I do? And it was like, well, I can go to school and make good grades. Like I can do that. I can do my homework. I can make A's. I can do that. So it's like breaking it down into the smallest, most manageable parts. There's a Japanese proverb that I really like that I'll probably butcher, but it's something like, how does a man move a mountain? By starting with small stones. And so like, that's a mentality that I keep in my head all the time, is that there's no such thing as a problem too big if you're willing to be persistent and just break it down and just chunk by chunk.
There you go. And honestly, if you're looking for another career, maybe motivational speaking.
Sure. Yeah. 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 Listen, I know how to hustle and I know how to like, yeah. So yeah. I'm here to motivate people.
But I think this links really well to our theme of today of intersectionality, because, you know, if I may use an example from American culture, this idea of the American dream, a big assumption as part of that is that people start on an even footing, that there's this idea that a lot of people, you know, fight for. And I can understand why it's an idea that's appealing and that you'd want as a part of your culture, that people work hard and they're rewarded for it, that you can build any kind of life you want. That sounds wonderful. An essential part of that, though, is also that people get support to at least get to some kind of universal starting line. You know, if it's about you work hard and you get rewards, well, what about if there's a shortage of jobs in your area? What about if the jobs that are available require certain qualifications? What if you're less likely to have certain qualifications because of things like your family, perhaps financial background? You know, what if you grew up near a college and somebody else didn't? There's so many nuanced factors that contribute to this. And I think it's a conversation that sometimes gets weaponized because you've described ways that you can counterweigh certain elements of your background. You know, you talked about scholarships are an option to get to college if financially that's not viable. And I feel like sometimes you can hear sort of rhetoric around that where it's like, oh, well, it's fixed because of scholarships. As if that's the whole story.
Yeah. And so that's never the whole story because things are more nuanced and complicated than that. I mean, I think we always want like an Aesop Fables kind of moral to the story. Like this is a general thing that we can all live by and it's true. And what's actually true is that there's some truth in these things, but that is actually more complicated than that. So if you work hard, can you get positive outcomes from that? Yeah, you can. And you could work hard and get nothing from that, you know? And so that's the part that like people don't do a good job at is kind of talking about all of the nuances that go into these things and the difficulty of it. And to your point, the loneliness or the lack of support that can happen, you know, in these spaces. So I think there's like two different sides to this. I think one is that myth of the American dream bootstrap. And so one side of that is the SES part, which is if you're born poor, you're probably going to die poor. Like that's what the research says. Like it's very difficult to change your SES. And there's even some more recent research that comes out.
I actually don't know what SES is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Socioeconomic status. Oh. And so like, you know,
I just never heard that abbreviation.
It's like the Oprah effect, right? So like Oprah like grew up in like these dire, and now she's like one of the richest people in the world. Mm-hmm. And like, that's kind of what we hold up as like, this is the American dream, or kind of like the Bill Gates story of like, okay, he was just a regular average everyday American and you know, now he's Bill Gates. And it's like, there's luck that goes into some of these things too, and certain circumstances that go into it. You know, for me, I was lucky to have like access to a library, you know, and I had a mom who was poor, but like she would take me to the library and like I had access to the things that I needed to kind of get my like edge. But not everybody even has that level of support. Right? Of like someone to give them a rock to like go someplace. And so if people ever feel lost or get frustrated about these sorts of things, I just want to say that that's normal because a problem that we have like in the world is we present problems like they have simple solutions. And oftentimes they have multifaceted solutions that have some things that might have a more immediate effect. But particularly when we're talking about intersectionality and kind of changing your stars, so to speak, like that's a long-term game. Like me saying like, okay, I want to be a psychologist at 12. I can't even get into college until I'm 18. So like that's already 6 years that I just have to like work at something, not even know it. And so, yeah, one of the approaches that I take with people is that they shouldn't minimize their bright spots. And that's something that I see people do a lot, where if I say something like, oh, you should journal, they'll say, well, that's not going to fix it. Or I'll say, well, you know, you should try to go for a walk or like go do the social event, connect with people. And sometimes people will just dismiss all of these things. And I'm like, no, like these are your bright spots. These are the things that are going to carry you that like 6 years or like whatever amount of time that you need to do. Like the same way that I'm saying that, like to tackle problems, you have to break it down into small steps. Like it's the same thing for taking care of yourself while you're tackling these problems, is you have to break it down into small steps. I can say without mincing like any words that I would be a far worse off person if I didn't have journaling. Far worse off. There are so many times where I didn't have access to another person, but I had access to a book. I had access to my journal so I could like write things down. I had access to like favorite TV shows or whatever it was, but I took whatever I had access to, and that's what I used to support myself and propel myself forward. And sometimes there are people involved and sometimes there wasn't, because that's also a consequence of poverty too, is that sometimes you can have less social supports, because for me, at least, I didn't have a parent who was working like a 9-to-5. You know, I literally, my mother was a, what they would call a private duty caregiver. So she would work in the homes of like wealthy white people and take care of their elderly family members. So she could be gone for months at a time, you know? And so that was my lived experience. So I had to get the bright spots wherever I could. And that's something that I encourage for people as well, because the basic generic things that people are going to tell you are going to work, they will work for you also, and you're going to have to do other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is where I sometimes describe it as like each of us having a mental health mixing pot. There's so much of the work is finding out what combinations of things make me better and propel me to be my best self internally, so that I can then be in the position to do so much of these things externally. And, you know, I'm glad from earlier you brought up examples like Oprah, because I think sometimes we can have certain people held up to us as she made it through. She broke through so many ceilings and got to where she's got. Therefore, what are you doing? What are you complaining about? And as we're highlighting, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes for her and for anyone.
Yes. And she's one person out of how many billion people on this planet? Like,
I love Oprah. One thing she's not is the norm. Like,
exactly. And so that's the thing too. Like, we have to talk about, you know, as a psychologist, I'm always talking to people about like what is typical, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like you have to have a good understanding of what is typical. And like what is typical is that you're not going to be Oprah. Does that mean that you can't have a good life, quote unquote? No, it doesn't. But what it means is, at least in my view, you have to work on identifying what it means to have a good life, what it means to be happy. And part of the issue is not only do we have this whole like American dream thing and we're holding up people like Oprah and like Bill Gates, and we're using them to kind of dictate like how we're supposed to live. Like Gwyneth Paltrow is not who I should, you know, base my whole life off of. I will never in my life have the money to buy an $8,000 vaginal orb or whatever it is that she sells on her website. Like, but that's the kind of stuff that's like kind of pushed towards us, right? And so like if you want to be able to afford that or live that kind of, then it forces you down only one kind of path. But you can be happy in all different kinds of circumstances, right? Like I know people who work minimum wage job. They're delightful people and extremely ecstatic about life every day, you know, because they know what their value systems are. And like, they get their happiness from places other than just their bank account, you know, and they're not stressing themselves out to try to get a corporate job that they're going to hate. They're like, this is my life. I enjoy it. It's a modest life. I have a great family or great friends. I play hockey every day or whatever it is that they're into, they're doing it. And so I think we have to not do as many comparisons. You need to use yourself as the starting point and not necessarily always use other people as like the starting point when it comes to how you're going to live and how you're going to take care of yourself.
Absolutely. I have a previous guest from the podcast called Dr. Joe, and a big part of his work, and indeed he wrote a whole book about it, is what he describes as the I am approach. Dear, that you start with your clients as this person is doing the best in their current circumstances. And so that's the starting point of, okay, now how can we tackle things, whether it is something like medication or whether it is, okay, this person has issues with their housing situation. They have a job that they hate. They have all these social factors. There's so many elements that play into this person's life. And by altering them and making various factors better, they can get to a new best position. I found that so refreshing when he described it to me, because it is, like you said, so different to the comparison culture we're used to. And, you know, I think we can sometimes get so caught up in that that we forget to question, do we even want that? You know, yeah. I don't want Gwyneth Paltrow's life. Like, I'm sure there'll be all manner of stresses behind the scenes. I mean, she's a famous woman that exists on the internet, so I can only imagine the death threats that she receives, just to think of one element that would be a stressor for her.
And I would hate the lack of privacy. Like, yeah. That would be something that I just could not deal with. Having people following me around, wanting to know everything about me all the time. No, thank you.
Yeah. And I think this is where, you know, it all kind of comes back to where you're looking at it from, right? What is your perspective? Because mm-hmm. You describe someone can be in a minimum wage job. They may feel more valued in that workplace than any number of CEOs. And so I think, like you've established, including with your own story, it's okay, what is the dream for me? Not can I have that person's dream or not? That's theirs. Let them have it.
Absolutely. And I think when you start with yourself too, you give yourself a lot of permission to like discover things, right? And I'm always encouraging people to do that. I'm just like, be open and be willing. Just be in the world and see what comes to you instead of fixating on like one person or one idea. Because when you do that, you shut down all other options. Like I was working with someone like a month ago and we were having a conversation about taking the advice of another person, right? And they said, well, if someone comes to me with a better idea, I'll listen to them. And I said, well, how do you define better? You know, because I was like, even that thought communicates to me that you're not open. You've already used the judgment of better, which means that whatever the person says, you're going to do a comparison to what you already have in your head. A lot of what we do is we make a decision about how we're going to respond. And then we just operate off of that versus just like, let me be open, take it in and see what is naturally happening in my own system. And when I encourage people to do that and have them practice that through various mindfulness techniques, sometimes they're very surprised by like what they discover when they're actually open. They're like, oh, I thought I was going to be really triggered by this or upset by this thing. And they weren't. Or there's other times when they thought they were going to be okay with something. And then they recognize that, like, wait, there's something off inside of me. I'm actually not okay with this situation. So I spend so much time just being like, just be open. Because happiness can look a lot of different ways. And just because there's a certain trend for what happiness looks like right now doesn't mean that same trend is going to be around in 10 years or that that trend is what works for you as a person. You know, and that's something that I see and that I have a lot of issue with is the trends. Like people are like, well, I want that kind of house because that's the kind of house that everybody else has. So an example of that is like the modern farmhouse, right? It's like, man, Joanna Gaines has really gone out here and like everybody's getting the exact same house. And if your house isn't a modern farmhouse, well, then what is wrong with you? You know, if you're not trying to go get a job and make $800,000 a year, like what is your problem? You know, you just like to like live in nature and go for walks every day and spend time with your kids and like get outside of the grind. Like, you can't really be happy with that, can you? You know? So there's just a lot of like judgment that comes in. And if we can remove the judgment, what you'll find is that the same way that there's a lot of ways to experience pain, there's also a lot of ways to experience joy. Like if you really just open yourself up to it. And it's something that's important, you know, going back to some of the grief thing that we talk about, right? Is that there's some things that are going to happen in your life that you have no control over and they're permanent. They're not going to change, right? And so when we talk about grief, this could be losing a person that you really care about, but it can also be something about yourself that you struggle with, right? Like, it could be the color of your skin, the size of your body, like, whatever it is. There might be something to grieve there, right? So, you know, one part of my story is I've been, you know, obese my entire life. A doctor told my mom I was obese at 6 months old and to put me on a diet. And so, yeah, up until a couple years ago, I was over 400 pounds, right? And like one of the things that I grieved in terms of my body size was that I grieved about that there were some people that were never going to just accept me and just let me exist. And so I grieved that because if I grieve it, I can let it go. And it doesn't have to be something that I live within, right? I don't have to run around trying to force myself to fit somebody else's idea about what my body should look like. I can grieve it, and then I can accept my body, and I can figure out how to be happy.
You've really got me thinking there, because we've discussed so many ways in which, you know, judgment comes and goes, and this comparison culture in many ways squeezes the opportunities to be happy out of our life. And it's such a shame, and it makes me feel it's a waste even. And we can talk about people like, you know, Bill Gates, and we've talked about a lot of like the financial factors in life, you know, and people can look at him and be like, oh, imagine to have that much money. He's trying to give it away. He doesn't even want it. He openly acknowledges he has an obscene amount of money. He doesn't know what to do with it. He has consultants specifically who work for him to try and help him get rid of that money in a way that's productive for the world. And so, you know, we can not only be so judgmental, we can forget even the nuance we know of other people, and we'll never know the full nuance of their life anyway. And so, like you've talked about, you know, when it comes to, you know, your body size, what has that got to do with other people? Not a huge amount. You know, I feel like one of the areas of stigma that still goes so incredibly unchecked is when it comes to body size, that it seems to still be, you know, in my culture and yours, something that just without question, people can go around and be fat phobic. And not only is it cruel, it's also cruelly ironic, because in so many cases, being horrible to somebody about their size not only achieves nothing, I would argue in so many cases, it actually is counterproductive. You know, what if that person has a binge eating disorder that relates to feelings of not belonging, relates to bullying over the years, and you're part of that story? Equally, there's plenty of research into how if you're coming from a background where you've been severely food deprived, the way you process food for the rest of your life may be altered. Your body may hold on to food more because when you've experienced starvation, your body's keeping score of that and storing it away of, well, I never know when my next meal will come. And, you know, these are just the examples that come first to my mind, but there's so many ways in which we don't know other people's stories. And, you know, with you being so insightful, I want to hear more about how you bring this into your work. So how do you champion intersectionality for your clients to understand each person that's coming into my office is a unique person with their own history, with their own factors in their life? And how do we navigate this complex mental health climate each of us have?
Yeah, I would say what helps me, particularly from the intersectionality piece, is one of the primary types of therapy I do is dialectical behavior therapy. And so in that, one of the things we're always looking at is what is this person's life worth living goals, right? And so like, that's always my starting point. It's like, you're here, a living, breathing human being. Like, what is going to make your life worthwhile to you? You know, and so we talk through those things. We identify, like, what are your values in different areas? Like, what are your values around your relationships? What are your values around health and fitness? What are your values around career? Whatever it is, like, we sit down and we map it out. And then everything we do is about kind of building towards that thing. And modifications happen because as people are in the therapy process, what they thought they wanted, they're like, wait, no, actually, I don't. I want something like different than that. But yeah, I think in the beginning of therapy, there's so much of just kind of getting a sense of what has the person's story been like up until this point. And so, yes, if a person's depressed or they have a trauma history and all of those things, we're working on that. But the way that I think about therapy, I will just say broadly that the first half of therapy is removing the things that you don't want to be there. And the second half of therapy is adding in all the things that you actually want to see in your everyday life. So let's say you have a bunch of unhealthy relationships. It's like probably the first half of therapy, we're going to be working on improving those relationships or getting rid of them, right? And then in the second half, it's like, okay, now that we've kind of done the spring cleaning, what do we want to be in the house? And so we work through that. And so I would say therapy with me is very much a mix of kind of practical elements and also existential elements. Because that's really, when you talk about the intersectionality of it all, you change one element of a person's intersection and it can change the whole story. And also, there's a person's like broad culture, but then there's also, well, how do they interact with that culture, right? Because like, how do you look at and identify with the Irish culture, right? It's like, you're probably not going to agree with everything that's within your culture. You're not going to feel 100% aligned with those things. Like, so you also have to kind of jump in there and say, okay, yeah, this person is Irish, or yeah, this person is African-American. And what does that mean to them? Because that could be a whole year of therapy right there, just like figuring that all out.
It's so true. And, you know, that was something that was a big part of, yes, therapy for me, was getting into the office of someone that understood this nuance. It made such a difference. And one thing that I find very interesting is, we were talking about off air, like the importance of understanding different backgrounds as a therapist, like how essential that is, because absolutely, I would encourage listeners to shop around and find primarily someone you feel comfortable with, because you're going to need to be very honest with this person and share a lot of things you may have never told anyone. And so particularly your first ever therapist, who you feel comfortable with, I would say don't put judgment on that. Just you go in and you find someone that you can build a dynamic with. But equally, we can't judge that from the outside. You know, somebody may feel, okay, for me, I want to be going to another Black woman. I want to have certain things in common because there's going to be a lot of things that I want to talk about and I want to be able to assume this person knows it. But equally, you know, I can think of people in my own life where it's been deeply affirming to go to a therapist who has a different background to them, whether it's ethnicity, whether it's gender, whether it's, you know, this person is an academic professional that studied for this role and I'm much younger or I don't have a degree. And yet they've really affirmed who I am and my thoughts and my experiences. And that can be deeply validating too. So I think we're so aligned on this, why it's important. But I wanted to add that piece of, it's important for everyone to be recognized for who they are, but it's also important that healthcare can include everyone. I want there to be an understanding of the importance of intersectionality, but also I never want it to be treated as a niche because it's so important.
Well, and it's not a niche because everyone has intersectionality. Mm-hmm. That informs your story and like who you are. And so if you're going to be a general practitioner and just see people, you need to have at least a baseline knowledge of the people who come through your door to expose yourself to all different types of backgrounds so that you can have the openness, the awareness of your implicit biases, and just kind of some lived experiences that can inform how you show up for the various patients that you serve. Because it's not a requirement that you have the exact same background, as we've already said, as the person. It is a requirement that you actually have the knowledge and can be an ally and provide affirmative care for the people that you're working with. And so I'm always encouraging people, do not delay taking care of your mental health. Your journey doesn't have to wait on that hypothetical therapist. Start now. And then if and when someone is available, you can transition to that other person to do different work with them than you did with the first therapist. You can go through different phases with your therapy.
Absolutely. And the only thing I have to add to that really is is a general thing in life. You know, I've experienced so much of firsthand how getting to understand cultures beyond my own benefits you so much personally. Absolutely, it's so important for your work. I'd say whatever career you're in, you need to understand that we're not living in a silo. And one of the things I found most beneficial is seeing that this is another way. That just because something is a normalized thing in my culture, and I may have good feelings about it or may not have good feelings about it, just seeing that there's entire different cultures out there where things are done completely different is so refreshing and can be so empowering. On that note, yay to intersectionality. Thank you so much for the work you do and for talking to me today. If people want to find more of your work, they can, of course, check out the Savvy Psychologist Quick and Dirty Tips podcast, which you host. I have had a previous host of the same podcast, Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, on this show. And I've now appeared on the show myself, so people can go check that out. Where else can people find you online?
Oh, I also have an Instagram called @kindmindpsych. And we do post mental health information on there for anyone who enjoys or needs that sort of content. And then otherwise, you'll probably find me bopping around, being quoted here or there. I'm an introvert who is reluctantly in the media a little bit.
Love that. All right. Well, we will wrap up there. Thank you again. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.